So, John, you say when you come up here and do this, you are humiliated. Where is John? Where'd he go? Well, listen, buddy, you and I are part of the same club, and it is okay. We're so glad that you are here this morning, and we're really encouraged by the sign-ups and the engagement that we've had from this church body the last couple of events, including the one that is for City Gospel Mission. I'm going to invite Bob Halpin up here just a second. And just to let you know that last week I mentioned that all the places that were available for us to serve at Matthew 25 Ministries, all those slots were completely filled up well ahead of time. And we are almost there with the sign-ups for City Gospel Mission. And let's keep that up. I think it's very important. But I just wanted to use this time just briefly to ask Bob a couple of questions just in terms of the logistics of what happens when we go down to that place and we engage in that ministry. We know a little bit about the ministry itself. We know that it is a program that is geared toward the physical, the emotional, and other needs of folks who have been homeless. It is a pretty tight-run program in terms of qualifications and to be able to stay in that program, and they have goals, and they really do work on the whole person, and it is proven through the years to be in something that is a hand up and not just a handout. And there are a lot of people who do a lot
and
of
faith-based.
Absolutely. But I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about what happens when we go down there. I know some of you have already been, and you know what it's like, but I'm going to ask Bob, for example, if you've signed up to help prepare food or if you've signed up to help serve food, what's involved in that? What do these people need to do?
Well, if you've signed up to prepare food, you show up about 4:30, and they kind of design who's going to do what. You get there, and they figure out what work you're going to do. Now, some people may have something they are specially cooking. I know Nick did a special dessert, so he wanted to do that, but you show up at 4:30 and then they map out what you do.
So if you've signed up to help prepare food and nobody has contacted you about bringing a certain kind of food or the fact that you're going to be in charge of this, just come and be ready to help prepare the food. There are people who are taking care of that.
Right.
And the same with the serving food. It's pretty easy and straightforward.
You just show up at 6:30 because we start at 7, and they'll assign you, get in a row, and map it out. Depends on what we have and how many we need.
Okay, that's great.
Pretty
Bob.
Simple.
Okay, the last question, and this is the one, the last several times we've done this, actually the people who sign up to help, this is the one that really has the least sign-ups. And I think it may partially be because maybe we're a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of sitting down at a table, maybe us and maybe me and my spouse, Jeannie and I have done that a couple of times. And you're sitting around at a table with a group of people, and there's some women there at dinner. And, you know, they've been addicted to drugs or dealing with alcoholism or have other family problems and issues, and they've been homeless. And there's the thought, you know, what am I going to say sitting down at dinner with people who maybe have gone through things and are struggling with things I have a hard time identifying with? What are some things that you can say, Bob, in terms that would help those conversations go well?
Yeah, first of all, that's all I've ever done was just sit with the people. I'm not good enough to do the other stuff, but I think you just be yourself. You know, you start out with basic, the simple, just like meeting any other stranger or person you don't know. You start out with, you know, your name, where you're from, how was your day, and that leads to other questions and just comes into a normal conversation. Yeah. And if you're not there that long, you're there an hour and a half, maybe sitting with them. But there's a group of people, and everyone kind of just joins in the conversation.
Right. And you find out over time it gets a little bit easier. You can actually have a conversation with them about what they're experiencing in the program.
Right.
What they've learned, what they like about it, what's, you know, the most difficult part about it.
How's it going?
And
in the program?
Yeah. So we just wanted to give you all sort of an idea of what that looks like. And you will be contacted if you signed up for that. You'll be contacted once again and told once again what time you have to be there, the location. It works in your GPS. I think some people do carpooling as well. But right. Really, it's a great ministry. I'm excited about what we've done there and what we'll be doing in the future. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Grady.
The beginning of this series asked the question, who needs the church? And it was based on a lot of data that is coming out and has been coming out for the last 10 or 15 years related to how this newest generation is viewing church and how they feel about church and whether church is even really relevant or not. So a couple of weeks ago, I started by asking the question this way, who needs the church? Right? Who needs it? It's not relevant. It doesn't speak to my needs today. It doesn't have a message that's different. It really makes no difference in the final outcome of things in the viewpoint of many. They feel that way. I prefer to say and ask that question this way, who needs the church? And my answer to that question is, we all need the church. And the church is important and the church matters. Not just because Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades and death and hell and the forces of death and evil will not prevail against it. And not just because Jesus says to his church, I want you to go to all the world and I want you to make disciples of all people, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. The idea of the church being relevant in the final analysis is not because of us. And that's not where the stress should be. And I'll say something more about that in just a minute. But it's about Christ. And it's about Him giving us a mission. And it's about Him calling us. And it's about not just surviving, but thriving. And I noted last week that it was a challenge to the early church, and I am of the conviction that the early church did not face an easier situation culturally or whatever other factors that you want to consider that was made it easier for them than us. In some ways, it was harder for them than us. And I think sometimes when we think about what Jesus has called us to be and what He challenges us to do to His honor and His glory and the wonder of being a part of that, I think sometimes we think it's just an impossible mission. Kind of like Tom Cruise in some of the recent Mission Impossibles. I know when you watch those movies, I know what you're thinking. I know what I'm thinking. I'm thinking this plot is so unrealistic, and this could not actually happen. And this I just think, oh, brother, come on, make it real. Yeah, right, this is going to happen. He's going to do that. You know, he, by the way, this is just kind of an aside, he actually participated in a lot of his own stunts in some of these movies, and I think he like broke his ankle or his leg doing one of his own stunts in one of these movies. But the whole concept of these Mission Impossible movies, and if you're old enough to remember Peter Graves and that bunch in the original Mission Impossible, is that nobody in their right mind could accomplish this in any way. And yet, by the end of the show, that which was impossible becomes possible. And so, I believe what God has called us to be and called us to do is not Mission Impossible, but it is Mission Possible, even with some of the things that we're facing culturally right now in this country, in the world. I've said a lot about the decline in terms, especially among millennials, younger adults, their viewpoint of the church, and it's relevant. And right now, probably among millennials, which is the largest age group, the most employed age group, the most mobile age group, and the age group that if churches are growing, they are finding ways to reach these people because they're the ones who are moving. Many of them are seekers, even though the vast majority of them are not involved anywhere. They're finding ways to reach those who are younger. But the decline has been felt in mainstream churches, in Protestant churches, in all different evangelical churches, independent churches, community churches. You just go down the gambit. Churches of Christ. The Christian Chronicle, just the last couple of months leading up through December into January, asked the questions, can we reach millennials? And part of that question was rooted in the reality that among Churches of Christ, the membership in Churches of Christ has declined over the last 10 to 20 years, along with most of what's happening in religion in general. And now, if you're in a place where Churches of Christ are very strong and very numerous, you can still probably do a good job of maybe growing pretty easily, especially if the church down the street makes some people mad and they want to find a new church. And then, so you're right down the corner, and if you're doing it a little bit differently from them, you can get some of their members. And in places like Dallas and Nashville, there are some churches that are getting bigger or staying pretty healthy, because sometimes it's they're swelling and they're not actually conversions, although some churches are converting people to Jesus and baptizing them into Christ. I know when I think about us in terms of the past, in terms of where we've been and where we're going, I know that in the past when we've grown, most of that growth, I'm just going to be honest with you here, most of that growth has not been people being converted to Jesus and being baptized into Christ. I know you're really surprised about that, right? Most of it has been a swelling versus actual people being converted to Jesus who did not know Jesus. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that that's the reality. And so while we live in this particular region of the country, Churches of Christ are not as strong. And certainly we live in an age, if somebody's had some connection with the Church of Christ and they move into the area, 20, 25 years ago, they would look for a Church of Christ. And they would look things up. They would maybe talk to people. They would come. But today, the attitude is a lot different, not just among those many times in Churches of Christ, not having this sense of identity with one particular group, but that's just all the way across the board. And that's the reality that we're dealing with right now. In my mind, in terms of just what it means, and if you're not familiar with Churches of Christ or the Church of Christ, just bear with me a little bit on this. A lot of these people do understand it, and I just want to mention this. There's some areas of the country, I know like some areas in the South, where there are some people who will absolutely not go to a Church of Christ, and they wouldn't dare go there because they say, I'm not going to go there because those folks over there, they believe they're the only ones who are going to heaven, and I'm not going to go over there if they have that viewpoint about who they are. That seems kind of arrogant to people. But in an area like this, in the Northwest and the Northeast, you don't have that built-in prejudice that you sometimes have in some areas of the South or other areas where Churches of Christ are pretty strong. And I think in some ways that can be good. And so while there are a lot of people out there who are mobile and among those who are looking, don't feel a particular tie to a particular brand of Christianity or a particular religious group among Christians, they're open to exploring things, and they're not coming in with some preconceived notions about a particular religious group. Although, like I said, among those who are in that young adult age range, most of them say that the church is really not on their radar. It's unimportant. It doesn't matter. And the last couple of weeks, I've talked about why, obviously, it does matter. So I'm not going to spend time today saying why it does. I just want to make some points in terms of application about what we do moving forward. And the first one is this, and this is kind of the big idea this morning. It's remembering that church growth and growing a church, whatever way or term you want to use on that, it's more than something about numbers or statistics. Ultimately, it's about winning people and leading people to Jesus. It's about those who are in Christ, remaining connected and faithful and engaged in their relationship with Him. And it's about reaching out to those who don't know Christ, who don't have faith in Christ, who have not responded positively to Christ. And that should be our primary mission and vision. That needs to be our primary goal in terms of the world out there. And so, a few months ago when our elders presented some of the visions and some of the goals related to some priorities that they had worked on, working together with other leaders, and presented the goal or the vision of having a church of 700 people in 10 years, and now it'd be less than 10 years, but whatever that time frame is, they said then, and we say now, and I say now, it's not about some arbitrary number. And I'll be tickled pink in 10 years, Lord willing, if you know, Grady's still here and I'm still alive and the Lord hasn't come back then, whatever the case is, okay, we understand, Lord willing. I will be happy if there are 700. I will be overjoyed if there are 1,000. We should first and foremost not think of it primarily in terms of numbers. That's an arbitrary number just to get us thinking that we want to reach people. Numbers are not about numbers themselves, but they ultimately should be about people, souls that need Jesus. And you go to, for example, in the New Testament, the book of Acts, there are several times in several places where they talk about how the church grew, and they give numbers related to how many people became Christians, right? Numbers are given. So apparently it was important enough for them to keep some sort of account, whatever you want to call it. How many on the day of Pentecost? How many can say first if this is a quiz game? Day of Pentecost, Acts 2, how many? 3,000. And that's not the only place in the book of Acts where they mention numbers. But it's not about numbers, it's about people. And that's the vision. It's about people being one to Christ. And it's about not forgetting the core values that we will live by as a church and place at the highest level in terms about how we live and our priorities as a church. That doesn't change. And some of you probably don't remember this, but not too long ago we talked about our core values here at Northeast that will guide us along this way. It's learning the Bible, knowing the Bible. It's integrity. It's about practicing what we preach. It's about leadership. It's about leaders at this church working together as a cohesive team to help us all to be better. It's about worship. It's about having our corporate assemblies and as an expression of heartfelt devotion and conducted with excellence. It's about love. It's about love in everything that we do and demonstrating to God and others. It's about service, reaching out to everyone within our diverse body and the neediest in our community. And it's about hospitality. It's about being friendly and welcoming to all of our guests. Now, I'd say if we continue to lift up those values, they are worth continuing to lift up, aren't they? They need to be at the core footing of everything that we do. And it's interesting to note, the more you read about the younger generation, the millennials, and those on either side of the millennials, especially those who are younger, they will tell you that they don't necessarily, like I said, have a negative view about church, but they do have an idea about what they would like or want or see in a church. And I know that there are some who say, you know, all millennials want, they just want to be entertained. They just want to go somewhere and not work or think, and they just want to go somewhere and be entertained, and that's all they want in terms of their experience with church. But I say that is not true, because when they're asked and when they're talking about their priorities, they will tell you this. What are they, if they're looking for a church, what are they looking for in a church? They are looking for a church, number one, that's going to keep it real And what I mean by that is they don't like hypocrisy, then you and I anymore like hypocrisy. It's a turnoff. It's a turnoff when we live lives that are phony. It's a turnoff when we come across as being salesy and gimmicky. People can spot that kind of thing a mile away, and a lot of times they will turn that off. But I tell you what they are looking for. They're looking for community, and they're looking for family. And in a couple of the books I've read recently about millennials and their viewpoints and how they can be reached and all of that stuff, all of those books say family and relationships are high on their priority. Millennials love their parents. They respect their parents, although they may not be going to the same church their parents went to. But they have good relationships with their parents. They respect the elderly. They want to find community somewhere. They want relationships. And something else they're looking for in churches, they want to find churches. When they're looking, they want to find churches that are making a difference in the world, that are trying to make this world a better place. They are looking for churches that are serving the community and getting out in the sometimes difficult, hard areas, working, reaching out to the poor and the homeless and others who are struggling. Those are priorities. And I say, that's good. That's good, isn't it? I think that's good news. And I believe understanding this can help us to be better in terms of being God's church and being a bridge to lead folks closer to Christ. Now, all of them may not be looking for Jesus per se. That's what we want to be. We don't just want to be some social organization that is important as feeding the hungry and reaching out to others who are struggling with addictions and all that is. That's important work. But that's not all we want to be, okay? We want to be people not only who are engaged in these kinds of things, but we want to be ultimately a place where we view ourselves individually and as a church as bridges to Christ in leading people closer to Jesus. And if I could have found a picture of a person just laying there with somebody walking across them, I may have come up with that. But I think you get the idea that Jesus is calling us to be bridge builders in this world. I know, and I can't remember, I think maybe it was in Tom Rainer's book, but in one of those books, when Barna did some research, and when millennials were asked, what's the primary picture you have of the church? And they were given several visuals to choose from. And once again, that's their perception, not necessarily always reality, but their perception was the church, it was somebody holding a Bible and pointing a finger and doing this. Now, there may be times when we need to hold our Bibles and do this. But that certainly doesn't need to be the only picture somebody has of what the church is all about. We're called to be bridges. And so, I hope you paid attention in the reading this morning. What I want to do is highlight very quickly. What time did I get started this morning? About what, 20 till? About 20 till maybe? I've made a vow to keep my sermons right around 30 minutes, and I'm going to stick to it. So, number one, how can we be bridge builders? The first thing is we need to work together as a team. We need to remember that we're not competing with each other, that we're working together to lead people to Jesus, and we're doing it sometimes in different ways. In the fifth verse, after all, who is Apollos, who is Paul, they're only servants through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants is anything or he who waters is anything, but God who causes the growth. It is a team effort. Everybody does not do the same thing. I believe if somebody asks you, how were you led to Jesus? How were you converted to Christ? And you answer that question, you would not just say the person who taught you the gospel or led you in the Bible study or preached that sermon that you listened to, if that's how it was done. I think you would probably list a lot of people that were responsible for you being where you are as a Christian. It was people who loved you and people who cared for you. It was about people who served you. It was about people who communicated with you and interacted with you in a way that made it feel to you like you were important and that you mattered. And so when I think of how I was one to Jesus, it wasn't just by those who spoke the word to me or taught me the gospel. It was by people who cared about Grady, reached out to him, had a relationship with him, and showed him love. All of those things are involved in evangelism. And I think in terms of this team effort, I think the most important thing for us is this. It's trying to have an outward focus versus an inward focus. And remembering that what we do here and who we are here is not just about us and us just doing things that we like or enjoy or have preferences for. Everything that we do needs to be looked at through that lens of how are we going to influence this community out here in this world. Number two, the focus needs to be kept where it belongs. And I've already mentioned that, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here. But in this passage here, as Paul speaks to the Corinthians, he says this. He says, no one should be carelessly building on what has been built. And he's talking about relating the church to this idea of being a building. He say, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10, and someone else is building on it, but each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. That is, ultimately, that's where we have to focus, point, lead people. It's not about converting people, leading people to us. It's about pointing people to Christ. And so I know while it might be disturbing in some ways for us to hear that young adults out there are saying the church is not important, the church is irrelevant, the church doesn't matter, a vast majority of young adults, if you were to ask them, how do you feel about Jesus? Do you know what the results would be on those surveys? Guess, Chad. It's way up there. And so there are a lot out there, they may be cool on the church, but a lot of them are very open to finding out and understanding more and seeing Jesus more clearly. And so, as I've already made the point, I'm not going to get off on this tangent again this morning, the church is important. The church matters, but we need to remember ultimately that people are going to be won into the relationship they have with others, including the body of Christ, by being one to Jesus. And if they're one to Christ, as Paul says, I didn't want to know anything amongst you. He says it here in this letter, except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That's where the focus was. That's what I wanted to know. And that's one of the reasons the Corinthians had the problems they did is because they were taking the focus off of Jesus and they were placing it on themselves. When Philip was led to an Ethiopian driving along in his chariot in the book of Acts, and we're told about that case, he's reading from the prophet Isaiah, and Philip is led to him, and he says, who is this man talking about? And we're told that Philip was led to him, and he began to teach him Jesus. That's where he started. And so that's what we want first and foremost, because when somebody becomes a follower of Christ and commits their life to Jesus, they're baptized into Him, they become a part of the body. And initially, I'm going to tell you right now, a lot of folks out there, they're not even asking the questions that we're answering. And if we focus on answering the questions that they're asking related to Jesus, then maybe later on, if we can get them to a certain point, then we can look at some of those other questions that are very, very, very important. Okay. All right, said enough there. Number three. And I'm going to zip through this one too. One of the best things we can do is think about the influence that I have. You think about the influence that you have. And when people see us as people who don't just look at Christianity like some hobby, or look at our relationship with Jesus as nothing more than punching my time card maybe once a week, maybe not once a week, whatever, or just going to church, or just viewing our Christianity as just a list of rules versus having our hearts on fire with passion for Jesus. There's a difference. And I believe when more of the world is seeing hearts and lives that are truly transformed, then that's going to be one of the most powerful ways that we can build bridges to Christ. Think about what the early church did. Here they are, and once Gentiles got on the scene, they are out there, and while there are inspired people in pockets who were able to speak inspired messages to them, they didn't have a New Testament. Yet they were able, eventually it came together over time, but that was through hundreds of years and copies and other copies being made, and then they were distributed, and it was done small scale up to a point, but there were people who were leading other people to Jesus without pulling out their New Testaments and reading it. And if it was a Gentile who was trying to convert a Gentile, chances are he probably wasn't going to the Old Testament too much to try to convince that Gentile to become a Christian. Listen, Paul was flexible with that. And that brings me to my fourth point. Yeah, I'm zipping right through these. We need to be patient and flexible, and we need to do our best to try to remove barriers. This is one thing that you will notice that the Apostle Paul does in his ministry. In the book of Acts, when he is out sharing and living his calling as an apostle to the Gentiles, he went to Jews as well. When he went to the Jewish synagogue, he quoted right out of that Old Testament all the time. Because who was he speaking to? He was speaking to Jews who had those scriptures, and they would understand where he's coming from. But what does Paul do when he goes into Athens and he's speaking to a bunch of non-Jewish pagan philosophers? Does he pull out his Old Testament and start quoting from the Old Testament? Yes or no? No. He takes a different approach. Now, ultimately, he wants to lead them to Jesus and the resurrection, but he is flexible enough to understand that there is a different audience here from here, and that sometimes different approaches are needed reaching this person and that person. And so he was nimble, he was flexible. When they kicked him out of the synagogue, he went right down the road and he found a lecture hall to speak at, and then he invited whoever wanted to come, and then sometimes the Jews and the Gentiles were converted in that context. But he wasn't so caught up in a certain method or a certain approach that he couldn't be flexible in building bridges and knocking down barriers that would make it easier to reach somebody for Christ. Do you understand what I'm saying? Does it make sense? Yes or no? And this is important because we just have, I don't have the mind, I don't have the experience of someone who is out there and has had experienced very little church. Maybe they've hardly ever been in the church in their lives. Maybe their parents went to church for a while and they quit. And they've grown up in an environment that is totally unchurched. And you think if you visit a place that's different from Northeast, it feels a little strange. It feels a little odd, doesn't it? And you're used to it. I'm used to it. We're used to churchy things and churchy people and things you do at church. But I don't think sometimes we think about how profoundly strange this experience, if someone was just coming off the street and wouldn't know anything about it, what they would think about it. Now, I'm not saying that we, you know, change everything that we do. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. I just think we need to be sensitive about those things. I was even thinking this week about words of songs. Some of the songs that we sing, are you washed in the blood, in the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb? Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? We're used to that. But in this article, this guy was saying, these are the sorts of words we take for granted, but if you view them through non-believing eyes, they sound nonsensical, or maybe even in this case, terrifying. To those who understand, this is obviously a glorious and a biblical image of redemption, but for those who don't, it might be a scene from Stephen King's Carrie. Are you washed in the blood? There's a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. O land of rest, for thee I sigh. Well, when the moment come, when shall I lay my armor by and dwell at peace at home? To Jesus Christ I fled for rest. He bade me cease to roam and lean for succor on his breast till he conduct me home. I could just keep on reading verses to songs that have been sung. I mean, I'm not advocating one song over another. I'm just trying to get us to think about things that we understand and don't think anybody about, although I personally think about, I'm not even going to say it, but I think there's one here that we just ought to completely remove just because it could be misunderstood. I've got to think about what I do when I'm up here. I've got to do my best to preach a message that connects with those who are Christians, who haven't been Christians long, to mature Christians. But I think I also need to think about how am I going to connect with more and more folks who aren't familiar with church. And if we want to reach those people, they're going to be here. And what am I going to say? And what are we going to say to reach them? All right. Last point. I'm coming down. That means I'm close to being done. All right, here's number five. Number five. Let's invite others. If you're going to put like your takeaway or a to-do on this lesson for the upcoming weeks or the upcoming couple of months, let's do this. Number one, I encourage you to find some material to read that relates to how this current young adult generation thinks about life and church and all that. We need to understand them. It's important that we understand them because I think it's going to help us in reaching them as well as others. We're not just trying to reach young people, but we want to understand that churches that are growing are reaching that demographic. And number two, I'm going to ask you to invite somebody sometime in the next couple of months to something that we're doing. And I feel a golden opportunity to get a foot in the door with someone. Maybe it's one of these millennials that's not real hot on the church, but maybe they'd be more than interested in going to Matthew 25 and doing something for those who have been hitting a disaster. Or City Gospel Mission, somebody that would be willing to help feed the poor or the hungry. Or invite them to a service. If you're comfortable doing that and you feel confident that if I'm in the pulpit, that, you know, that it's not going to drive them away, versus help lead them closer to Jesus, then do that. But most folks who are invited to something, well, about a significant percent will accept an invitation. And so I believe as a foot in the door, and we're going to have a lot more service-related things this year, and we're already planning them out. And so I'm encouraging you not only to get engaged yourself, but invite somebody to come and serve with you. And that will help, I think, for people to be exposed to other Christians and what we're like, and that will be attractive to them. But listen, we certainly don't want to be manipulators. I don't want us to be accused of being gimmicky or doing things just to get more people or more numbers. I want our heart, I want my heart to be passionate for Jesus and for other people to know Jesus. And if it is, then God's going to work with all my rough edges to help me be better at that. Right? Okay, now it's time to sing. I hope you were encouraged by this lesson. I know sometimes when I preach, I'm my worst, hardest enemy. I think, did I make the points the way I wanted to? I run through it in my mind all the time. Listen, Jesus, it's about Jesus. It's about pointing people to Jesus and people seeing Jesus and understanding Jesus and being drawn by Jesus. He's the power. He's the power. I'm not the power. You're not the power. Jesus is the power. Jesus is the draw. Let's sing.